There's no gin in that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have the opportunity here with the Deputy First Minister to ask any area at all, preferably related to this debate. So I'd prefer if you use the microphone, because that way everybody can hear you. I've got a first question here. Thank you.
Hi, Nicola.
Hi.
You talked very much about Scotland there, obviously, and you talked about the social argument, democratic, obviously. Would you feel the same if you were, say, Cornish, and have the same view? You've drawn a kind of barrier around Scotland, and perhaps it's not a concern of ours, but would other areas of the UK be able to have exactly the same argument, and why are they not having this debate at the moment?
Well, I mean, I can't really answer that on behalf of other parts of the UK. I'm a decentralist at heart. I think power should lie as close to the people affected by decisions as possible. You know, Scotland is a nation. Whether we choose to be an independent country or remain as a nation as part of the UK, it is indisputable, historically and in terms of current debate, that we are a nation. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to make that case on that basis. It's not for me to argue whether Cornwall is a nation or not, but I think the arguments for Scotland are pretty straightforward and simple in that respect. Now, what conclusion you reach is entirely up to your own decision-making, but I think the fact that Scotland is a nation is not disputed by anybody. I do believe there's a case in England for greater regional devolution, where particular regions of England have had the opportunity to vote for regional assemblies. They have chosen not to go down that route, which is their absolute entitlement. So, you know, it's not for me to dictate otherwise. I also think, I mean, you're right, I talked about the democratic argument entirely from the perspective of Scotland, as you would expect me to do. But I actually think there's a very powerful democratic argument that the people of England can make about the way we are governed right now. I mean, Scottish MPs can go to the House of Commons, as they frequently do, and vote on issues to do with education in England, the health service in England, often, particularly in the last Parliament, sway those decisions. I mean, it was the votes, I think, of Scottish MPs that swayed the vote on foundation hospitals in England or tuition fees during the last Labour government. And those MPs that can do that can't vote on health and education as it affects their own constituents because it's devolved to the Scottish Parliament. If I was an English voter and saw a Scottish MP sort of sway a decision that affected me but didn't affect their own constituents, I would be pretty upset at that. So I think the people of England have a right to be less than content with the democratic governance that we have within the UK at the moment.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm puzzled at the silence there seems to have been about the potential implications of the referendum vote itself. If a clear majority in the referendum, over 50%, says yes, that must be fairly clear. But I'm puzzled if the outcome might be 40% yes and 30% no, and perhaps 30% don't know. Is that seen to be sufficient an outcome for independence to be granted?
There won't be a don't know box on the ballot paper, so there will the referendum will be decided, which is perfectly democratic, by a majority of people who vote. So if you want my personal opinion about turnout, and this is based on just conversations with people around the country just now, I think turnout will be very high in the referendum. I think you'll see people who perhaps don't routinely vote in general elections will come out to cast their vote because they feel the importance and the significance of this decision. So I think turnout will be very high, but whatever the turnout is, the result will be determined by the majority of those who vote. So if a majority of those who vote yes, then that will be the result. And contrary to that, if a majority of people who vote no, then that will be the result. One issue which I thought you were going to ask about is in terms of what happens if there's a no vote. Now, I don't particularly like to talk about what happens if there's a no vote because it's not what I'm campaigning for. So I won't dwell on this point. But there is a question for those who are arguing the no case just now, because All of them, I think, without exception, are saying vote no to independence, and if you do, we'll give you some more powers because we think there's an appetite for more powers for the Scottish Parliament. But none of them are yet prepared to say exactly what more powers they will give. And I think there's a need to pin some of these people down to, well, what exactly are you promising and how could we be sure that you would deliver it? I strongly suspect that if Scotland votes no, which I hope it doesn't, then it'll be a long, long time before you see any more powers for the Scottish Parliament, because the Westminster establishment will think they've kind of put that issue in its box for the time being.
If the Kingdom of Fife and the Archipelago of Orkney decide they want independence on exactly the same arguments, what will be your response to that if you are already independent in Scotland?
Well, I believe in far greater autonomy for different parts of Scotland, and you know, I believe that almost regardless of whether Scotland's independent or not. As I said earlier on, I'm a decentralist at heart. I don't believe in independence just so we can transfer powers from London to Edinburgh. I think we need to devolve powers much lower down than that. I think that argument is actually even stronger when you're dealing with island communities. You mentioned Orkney and Shetland because of some of the distinctive characteristics and some of the distinctive issues in island communities. I think that argument is stronger. So I would argue very strongly that if Scotland was independent, then we should be looking to increase greatly the autonomy of the constituent parts of the country. I think Orkney and Shetland both voted majority SNP at the last election, so I'm hopeful that we'll get a yes vote in both of these islands, as we will across the country. But you know, I think their arguments for greater autonomy are well made and have a lot of legitimacy.
How does the argument for greater decentralisation sit with membership of the EC?
Well, one of the frustrations we have right now, and again, I think this should be a frustration for people in Scotland, regardless of what side of the independence debate you happen to be on, is that we are in the European Union, and I'll come on to say in a minute why I think it's right that we're in the European Union, but we're in the European Union right now with no seat at the top tables in order to make our voice heard where it should be and as loudly as it should be. And why does that matter? Well, you know, if you look at the devolved responsibilities of the Scottish Parliament, you know, health, education, rural affairs, fishing, farming, economic development, all of these issues, to a greater or lesser extent, are seriously impacted on by decisions taken in the European Union, and yet we can't independently represent our interests. So if there's a big fishing issue in the European Union, as there regularly is, Richard Lockhead, our fishing secretary, has no right whatsoever to sit at the top table of Europe and argue Scotland's case. He can't even speak unless he has the permission of the UK minister. Now, I just don't think that is right. I mean, there's a very current example just now, which you might have seen in some of the papers over the last couple of days, around the allocation of structural funds in Scotland over the next number of years, where as a result of the deal that was done in Europe a couple of weeks ago to settle the budget over the next few years, there is a potential for Scotland to be seriously disadvantaged in the allocation of structural funds. Now, you know, if you go through, as I have done, the paper summarising the deal that was reached, you will see lots of countries like the Czech Republic, Germany, lots of countries that have done separate deals with the European Union to mitigate the fact that some of their regions might be losing out in structural funds. Now, the UK didn't argue for anything like that, even although the Highlands and Islands will be one of the issues that could be, you know, quite seriously hit. So I believe we should be in Europe. I think it's in our overwhelming economic interest to be in Europe and in the single market. There are a lot of jobs in Scotland depend on us being in the single market. But I believe it would be better, much, much better, for us to be independently represented in Europe, making sure that we can articulate our own interests and argue the things that matter to us. And I believe that very strongly.
Gentlemen over here, then over here. Take two questions, actually.
Sure.
I wonder how you are going to get your message across in the next year and a half, considering you've got a hostile media using what I would often call unfair arguments and invective rather than logic, as you read from the likes of the Scotsman or Telegram Seminar, some other less than brilliant organs like those. Allied to which, you've got the two arguments, haven't you, from Cameron, that you have to have the decision first and then we discuss it, but turns his head the other way when it comes to Europe. Don't you think that, I think there's going to be a difficulty getting what you might call an intellectual argument in the next 18 months. I think that's a challenge.
Okay, first question, take the second one.
Good morning, Mr. Hume. I was very surprised when you said the important things were democratic, economic, and social. You seem to have missed out something that's even more important, and that is the security of this nation, the security of all the people. We are now in a very dangerous world with cybernetic attack and so forth. And I believe that a separation of Scotland will reduce the security for all the people, and I emphasize all the people, of this island. I would like very interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay, two very interesting ones there.
Okay, I'll take them in the order they were asked. I probably should start my answer to the first question with saying don't get me started on the media, because I could be here for quite a long time and it wouldn't sound particularly rational. Having said that, to try to be more positive about it, if I'd been standing here, you know, 10 years ago, as I did to audiences like this, what would have been said to me then was the SNP can never win an election because the media is so hostile, because the media was very, and still is, in my view, often hostile to the SNP. But we did win not just one but two elections. So I guess what I'm saying there is it's possible to get a message across even although you have a media that is pretty hostile, and that gives me a lot of optimism for the next 18 months. I do think you're right, though. I think we are, and I don't mean we as in politicians, that politicians shouldn't like the media because the media would be doing its job properly if politicians like them. I think the general public is badly served by the media we have, where they go for the headline rather than actually engaging properly in the issue. You know, you can guarantee if there is something that is 99% positive and 1% negative in anything, the media will report the 1% negative. I don't know why they do it. I think they think it's what sells newspapers. Their circulation figures would suggest the opposite is the case. So I think the public are badly served. It's probably why less and less people, fewer and fewer people, buy newspapers these days and get their news from different sources. Social media is becoming increasingly important. I'm not one of these people that would say it's yet as important as mainstream media, but it is certainly coming up the outside lane and will take over in the next few years from newspapers and the more traditional media outlets. So, you know, if you ask me how do we get our message across, we do it in the ways we have done over a number of years. We do it as best we can through the mainstream media. We use social media. But from a politician's perspective, the best way of getting your message across is talking to people directly, whether it's on their doorstep or in their community, their workplace, in audiences like this. And that, I think, is going to be perhaps the most important way of communicating over the course of this campaign. Security is fundamentally important, sir, and I won't surprise you to hear I disagree with your conclusion on this, but let me talk just a little bit more about why I disagree. In terms of defence, firstly, Scotland is perfectly capable of defending ourselves. And one of the, I started my remarks by talking about a number of the papers we will publish over the next few months, and defence will be one of those, outlining in some considerable detail how an independent Scotland would defend itself. I mean, if you look at the financial contribution we make, and this is one of the things that is demonstrated through the government expenditure and revenue series of papers that I spoke about earlier on. Scotland contributes to UK defence somewhere between £500 million and £1 billion more than is actually spent on defence in Scotland. So, you know, the only point I'm making there is that financially we are perfectly capable of defending ourselves. And, you know, clearly there are considerations and decisions that an independent Scotland would make about what the focus and what the purpose of our defence forces would be. You know, there would clearly be a, you know, a very strong maritime focus on that, given our fishing and our oil interests. We would, you know, require to make sure that the defence forces we have are geared towards the particular needs and we have as a country to defend ourselves. Moving on to security, and I had the dubious pleasure of being before the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee on some of these issues a few weeks ago. An independent Scotland, of course, would have a responsibility to ensure that it had the domestic security arrangements in place. We face and would face the same threats. You talked about cybercrime. You know, an independent Scotland would face that threat just as the UK does, just as other countries across the world does. But an independent Scotland would, I am absolutely 100% sure, cooperate very closely with the existing security services across the UK. And we would do that not just because that is in Scotland's interests. We would do that because, as you rightly say, it would be in the interests of the other parts of these islands that we had that very close cooperation. That flows from the geography we have and the shared interests we have. So these are important matters. But, you know, there are plenty other relatively small countries right across the world who do these things perfectly well and contribute to global security as well as taking the decisions that protect their domestic security. And an independent Scotland as part of the global family of nations would be just as capable of doing that.